The Sports Interview with Anne Liguori podcast is brought to you by iBeCool Luxury Athleisure Wear for Men and Women, featuring the exclusive ice-fill cooling technology, along with SPF 50 plus sun protection. Look your best. Protect your skin. Visit ibkul.com to learn more. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my honor to say hello to Stan Smith, an athlete I've been following for a long time, two-time major champion. He won the U.S. Open back in 1971. He won Wimbledon back in 1972. And Stan has really been synonymous with Hilton Head Island and Sea Pines Resort, having been here for 50 years. Welcome to Sports Interview, Stan. It's such an honor to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to have you here to see our beautiful resort. It is a special place. I came here in 1971 in between basic training and going to Washington where I was stationed. And I fell in love with the place like most people do, and I became the touring pro. And so it's been 50 years here as a touring pro and ambassador, really, for Sea Pines Resort.
That has to be unprecedented to be in one spot for so long, especially with your schedule internationally. Traveling everywhere for corporate events and tennis. And boy, 50 years. Congratulations. That you must just love it.
Well, you know, I came and helped them start the tennis program. And we probably had more nationally televised tournaments than any resort in the country or the world. We had the CBS Tennis Classic was the first. It was a men's event. And then we had the Family Circle Magazine Cup tournament for 25 years. It was the largest women's only event on NBC. And then we've had the World Cup Invitational, which was, in my opinion, probably the greatest event you could possibly have. If they did it today, it would be unbelievably popular. We'd had four of the top men in the world and four of the top women, and either a man or a woman could win the event. You played two singles, the semis and finals. You played two mixed doubles, semis and finals, and you have a doubles final for both the men and women. And the player that wins the most matches would win the event. So Forbes was the sponsor. And so one year I played with Billie Jean, and she came in first. I came in second. And going into the last match, if we lost that match, we'd be dead last. If we won it, we'd tie everybody else with a 2-2 record. And so it was an exciting event. That was televised 15 matches, and it was showed every Sunday for 15 weeks. And then we also had the World Couples Championships. We had the Correll Championships, which is a senior event that Jimmy Connors won a couple times. And then over the years, we've had a lot of exhibitions that I played in, and we've done that. But we had 10,000 people watching the Family Circle Magazine Cup the last couple of years.
Wow, it seems like we have to resurrect somehow that co-ed event, that mixed event. Sounds like it was really a lot of fun. And as you say, it would be really exciting, you know, to use some of the players nowadays.
You know, think of Roger and Arafa and Novak and maybe Andy or some other player in the men's side. Then you have Serena and Venus and, you know, any number of women's players on the women's side. So it's very exciting knowing that either a man or a woman could win the event. And so it was an exhibition type event in a way because it wasn't huge prize money, although it was pretty good prize money at the time. But you'd have to guarantee these players, you know, in $500,000 to come.
Yes, times have changed, right, since you turned pro and you played pro from 1969 to, what, 1985? Is that correct?
About that, yes.
Right. And the game, how has the game changed, in your opinion? Obviously, prize money and more tournaments, you know, all over the world. But when you look at the game of tennis now, what stands out the most as far as how it has changed since you played professional tennis?
I'd have to say that internationally, it's stronger than ever before. You know, we had, at the time, mainly Americans, Australians, a few Europeans, a couple South Americans. A couple, you know, Eastern European country players, but, you know, now there's so many good players from so many countries. All the stands, the Kazakhstan, the Afghanistan, you know, all these different countries have two or three good players, Serbia, Croatia, of course, You know, South America has had good players, and all over Europe now is really strong. And so, you know, it's very competitive, both on the women and the men's side. The women's side has even gotten better, relative, I think, because of so many great athletes playing the game on the women's side as well as the men's side. And it's become a business, you know, and it's being covered greatly by the various networks all around the world. And sponsors, of course, because of that, are involved. And so that really makes the prize money. So the prize money, of course, has gone up dramatically. And the players have become stars, not only in the United States or in their own country, but internationally. And so, you know, when you say Rafa in Italy or Rafa in Australia or South America, they know who Rafa is. It's not some, it could be a soccer player, but it's going to be Rafa Nadal, no matter where you're living in the world. So it's, you know, Federer is now become the ambassador for tennis worldwide. And he's making the most money per year of any athlete. So it's, that side of the business side has been dramatic. And the game itself has changed, and that the rackets, of course, are the biggest change. And those are, rackets are bigger, stronger, lighter, and you can create more power, more spin, and more control. So it's really given some parity to the game, because more players can play well with these rackets, whereas in the old days, you had to dwell in the center of that racket, otherwise you'd lose a lot of power and control.
I still cannot believe how I hit the Jimmy Connors Wilson T2000. That was my very first racket.
I don't know how anybody did. I don't know how Jimmy or Billie Jean or Clark Gradman or some of these players were able to play great tennis with that racket. It seems almost impossible.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we're going to talk golf in a second because I know you're a passionate golfer. But, you know, you mentioned all these international stars on the men's side. You know, obviously Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. We miss the Stan Smiths and the Jimmy Connors and the John McEnroes, the American men, the names, the Andy Roddick, Pete Sampras. You know, obviously Venus and Serena Williams have done us proud here in our country. But we do miss the American top men, professional players. But as you say, the sport has just expanded incredibly quickly on a global level.
Yeah, there's all sorts of reasons. I was the director of coaching for our U.S. program from 86 to 96. And it was that period of time when we had, you know, Sampras, Courier, Agassi, Chang, Todd Martin, Mal Washington. We had a lot of good players coming through, and it wasn't necessarily because of our program, but just it was a great cycle of players. And on the men's side, you had, you know, Davenport, Chanda Rubin, and then of course you had the Williams sisters come along. And so it's been exciting. We've had you know, good men and women players, but you know, Andy is the last one to win a U.S. Open. That's just almost 20 years ago. So it's been a little bit of a dearth in that, but we do have some good players. We had 17 out of the top 100 ranked going to the U.S. Open this year. As far as numbers are concerned, none of those players got to the semis or finals, but we do have more. That's on the men's side. The women's side, we've got some good young players. Coco's coming along and others, but then, of course, you had these two girls come from almost nowhere, Raducanu and Fernandez, and so they took the U.S. Open by storm. And then there's a young guy from Spain named Carlos Alcaraz, who is going to be number one in the world, in my opinion, unless something happens. He is that good. I got another guy from Italy named Sinner, who is going to be fighting against him as well as some other good young players. And we have some good Americans in that. We've got Korda Nakajima, who is a good player, and Brooksby, who are our three best really good young players that could be in the top 10 or 20 in the world, and who knows, you know, more. You know, the Korda family story is unbelievable, and I've got a bit of a crush on Jessica, and my wife knows it, so it's not a secret, but the Korda family is pretty amazing.
It is a truly incredible sports family. I remember covering, you know, the father, Peter Korda, when he played professional tennis, and now Jessica, Nelly, and as you say, the son is a top-ranked tennis player. So what a sports family. And the mother was a professional tennis player as well.
In the world, and so she was a quality player from Czechoslovakia. Both she and Peter were from Czechoslovakia, and they're now Americans, and they've got these three superstars.
It's very exciting. Well, that's a good transition to golf, since that's a tennis and a golf family, right, Stan Smith? And you told me you started playing golf 50 years ago when you first came here to Hilton Head, to Sea Island.
Yes, in fact, I had a Wilson contract with my own, you know, wood tennis racket, but I remember going to Chicago and picking out some golf clubs with my agent myself, and so we... First time I really played was with those Wilson clubs, and I got to play here at Sea Pines. And I remember the first time playing the 18th hole, I hit a, you know, drive in the fairway. I hit another shot just the right of the green. I chipped it up and two-putted, and I said, I thought this was supposed to be a hard hole. And they said, it's a par four. You know, I thought it was a par five when I played it. So it's a special course. Pete Dye is a special designer, and, of course, we have a museum here. Honoring Pete Dye and going through sort of his history of courses that have been played. And about 15 years ago, I became a trustee on our Heritage Classic Foundation board, and so we run the tournament here, and the tournament's been going for 52 years, and so I've been able to be involved with the charity side of that and also giving a perspective of a player's perspective. You know, as I'm a player as a tennis player, but the same kind of things go on with golfers as they do with tennis players. And so it's a great event. The players really love this course because it's so unique and it's challenging. It's now become sort of shorter than some of the other courses, but it's still really tough. And you've got to hit the ball well and accurately. And the greens are so small, you've got to be pretty accurate to hit, you know, all the greens. Certainly almost no players hit all the greens when they play here, and I'm lucky to hit any of the greens when I play here because it's so tough.
What's your best score here?
You know, I think I shot a 78 one time, which was pretty good for me, but normally it's just so difficult to, you know, there's so many ways to get hurt on this course. There's a few water holes that grab you. And then if you hit the ball a little bit off center, you're having to deal with trees and trying to hit to these little greens. Once you get on the greens are not that difficult, although they're subtle in many ways as far as the breaks are concerned. And the pros even struggle a little bit sometimes with the subtlety of the greens. They're not, hugely undulating, but they are subtle. So it's a great test for anybody at any level.
Did golf come naturally to you, Stan, when you first started playing, or did you really have to work at it?
Well, most tennis players pick it up relatively easily, you know, at first. And then to get really better at it, then it gets to be a challenge like it is for everybody else. But I remember one of the pros here was named Stan Graff. He was here probably 30, 40 years ago. And he was a football player for the Stanford. He was a quarterback on the Stanford football team. And he would actually do analogies of movement with the club and try to make an analogy of tennis for me to help me understand it. And most tennis players kind of don't finish and they hit a slice, and like most players do. And so I had to understand that idea of finishing the swing like I would a forehand. And so that helped me along the way. And so I've had some... Skip Malik has been the guy that's helped me the most. He's been here at Sea Pines for a long time as well, but I always get a lesson from him, a couple times a year and try to get, the movement back. But it's always been frustrating anyway, that's for sure.
You know, golf is such a difficult sport. You have some of the greatest athletes in the world, yourself in tennis and Michael Jordan and in basketball, Wayne Gretzky. They're just so humbled by golf. Do you find that's the case, and that's why you probably are so passionate about golf, because it's one of these sports where you just can't perfect it.
Well, it's true. You know, when you hear about the fact that one day you got it, the next day you don't. I remember playing at Augusta. I was fortunate to get on there, and I shot a 78, I think, at Augusta. And I thought that I'd figured out the game. I came here and played at the course you played today at Atlantic Dunes and shot like a 92. You know, I'm thinking, you know, this is a tougher course. Augusta's a tougher course than this, but, you know, I thought I'd figured out the game. And I've had some good scores along the way. I shot a 66 one time, which was the only time ever in the 60s.
Where did you shoot that?
And that was at Carlton River at the Pete Dye course there. It's a nice course. There's two courses, a Nicholas and a Pete Dye course. And it was one of those days that everything, just the hole was look as big as a basketball. And it didn't miss any drives and hit balls close to the hole. So the next day, I think I shot an 87. So, you know, it was one of those things that brought me back to earth. And it seems like it should be easy. I think of that ball sitting there just laughing at you. It's not moving, and I'm not moving. And it seems like it should be pretty easy, but I understand the game enough now to know that it's every day is going to be a challenge for you, no matter who you are. I've seen Nicholas shoot, you know, I think he shot a 78 or 80 at Augusta one time, and that seemed like it was impossible for a guy like that, but, you know, that made you realize that it could happen to anybody.
I don't know if you see that much of a difference in a professional tennis game as you might with a professional golfer, where, you know, as you say, you know, a pro can shoot a 66 one day, and God forbid he's shooting a 75 the next. In tennis, you can have a bad day, but I don't think the highs and the lows are quite as extreme. Do you agree with me?
Well, there's a few things that are different. One is that you can lose the first two sets at the U.S. Open tennis and come back and win the match and actually win it fairly easily, you know, 6-1, 6-2, 6-3, the last three sets. So you can play terribly. In golf, if you have two or three doubles, if you're a pro, you have almost no chance to make the cut, let alone win the tournament. So that's one thing. Another thing is in tennis, you can hustle and run and run down balls and just get it back and use your athletic ability to just kind of get the ball in play and hang in there that way when you're not feeling very good in your timing. But in golf, you can't do that. You just got to hit the ball, and you can't rely upon, you know, running and getting the ball back in that way. So that's another difference. And, of course, the ball is not moving, but it's so small, and the club head is pretty small. And I think that it seems like there are more taller players now that are doing well in golf, like a DJ Kepka and some of these guys, but smaller players seem to be closer to the ball, and a lot of them are able to generate unbelievable power. Like McIlroy is able to hit the ball so far, and he's probably 5'8", 5'9". And, you know, even Jack was not that tall. He's even shorter now, but, you know, you got Jack and Palmer and Player who are not real big players. And today you've got a lot of players that are not huge, super big players, but then you're seeing a lot of taller, stronger players, you know, creating more club head speed and therefore hitting the ball further. So I think it is. You're getting to see the golfers now more athletic, you know. And so I always joke when I'd do a clinic, a corporate outing, for instance, and there'd be half the group would be playing tennis and half would be playing golf. And so the night before I'd say, okay, all the athletes are going to be playing tennis from 10 to 12. And all the non-athletes are going to be playing for any time in the morning. And so then the golfer would come up and say, you know, we have to hit our first serves. We can't hit a second serve. We've got to play that ball. And I'd say, well, you know, in tennis you've got to run to the ball. In golf you can ride a golf cart, you know. And so we go back and forth. But I have tremendous respect now for golfers. Physically they're getting better than they were. And I think that you get the Tiger look. Even Player was the guy that really started it. Way before Tiger, that showed the physical attributes can be developed and can be maintained, whereas you get some of the other golfers that weren't too fit. But in tennis, you know, you've got to be fit. I mean, I think the tennis players and maybe basketball players are probably the fittest athletes out there, you know, overall with stamina, with speed and strength and that sort of thing. It's a challenge. And so we're seeing golfers do that now. And like I said, I've got a lot of respect. Plus, I have a lot of respect for the hitting the shot under pressure. And that happens in tennis with the great players. You see Djokovic, you know, down match point to Federer a couple times at the U.S. Open Finals and at Wimbledon and coming back and winning and hitting an unbelievable shot down match point under pressure. So that happens exactly the same way in golf. It's just no coincidence. The greatest players are the ones that can perform under pressure in those big moments.
It sounds like you talk a lot about the similarities and the differences between the two sports. It's so fascinating to me. And you mentioned, you know, the size and the fitness. You know, Gary Player, short, but he won all over the world, and you know, 9 major titles, 9 senior majors, and yet, as you say, working out every day. He's 86, continues to do his sit-ups and his push-ups. I know, because last year I was honored to be doing them right alongside him when we did a TV interview. In tennis, the tall guys are starting to move better, right? They're starting to dominate, and that was not always the case in tennis. You know, it was all serve, but they couldn't really move as well. Now they have the whole package. So, as you say, they're dominating.
Well, you're seeing the better athletes playing tennis, and you're seeing the bigger, better athletes playing. And imagine if you had the NBA players playing tennis. Some of these guys that are 6'6", 6'7", 6'8", that move, you know, like a dream playing tennis. And, you know, we see a few on the men's tour. You know, you've got a couple 6'10s, 6'11s in Isner and Karlovic and now Pekka, and there's some good Americans actually that have been tall like that, but they don't move like some of these basketball players. I mean, they're not great athletes, but we do have some great athletes that are not so tall that are moving great and you know, are generating great power with serve and then ground strokes as well. So, you know, the interesting thing about when I started getting involved in tennis and golf is that the serve is almost exactly the same set of movements as the golf swing. Now, the golf swing, you take the club back, and from the backswing, you start with your knees, then your hips, then your trunk, shoulders, your arms, and then the club, and the hands and the club. Well, in the serve, you get in the back, in the position at the top of the swing, and you start with your legs, your hips, your shoulders, your arm, your hand, and the racket. I mean, it's the same sort of motion, just going in different ways. The serve going up, and the club going down for the golf swing. So that is a very, very similar move, and the timing is such. You see a guy like Ernie Els, the Big Easy, that the timing is there, and he doesn't even look like he's trying. Then you see a Roger Federer hitting that forehand. And I call it liquid power. And it's because the timing is there and there's a great athletic ability, but all the parts of the body are working at the right time and they're all working and there's not any part absent in the swing. And that's why Roger gets tremendous speed on that forehand where he doesn't even look like he's generating power. So it's fun to do this analysis of the golf and the tennis and see timing is critical in both sports, but even the swing itself is very similar when you look at the golf swing and the serve particularly. And of course, the same thing with the forehand. The great big forehands we see out there, like Berrettini, who hits that forehand as hard as anybody in the game, he loads with his back leg, and then he fires the right hip. And at what follows the right hip is the shoulder and the arm and the racket. And of course, that generates the power along with that perfect timing. And so the athletic movements involved in both these sports are very similar.
Interesting that you say that, because I played a lot of tennis growing up, and I think the biggest difference for me, Stan, was when I started playing golf was in tennis, you know, when you hit the top spin forehand, I would come up a lot off my feet. I was always in the air with my ground strokes. And in golf, you have to plant your feet. And pretty much it might be a similar turn as in tennis, but your feet are really grounded. I don't know if you had that issue or not, but that was my biggest problem. I had to really learn to plant my feet in golf.
Well, the tennis swing has become, the forehand particularly, has become a violent swing. And you're loading on that back leg, and you're pushing off that back leg. And, in fact, most of the forehands are hit when you come off the ground as you hit it. Today, you look at the big players, all generate tremendous rotation from it's a violent move from the right hip. And the hip is going so hard and so fast that the back foot comes forward in the follow through, rather than staying back like Chrissy, you know, and nice, you know, perfect form and very precise. But today it's still pretty precise with these rackets, but the players are coming off the ground, particularly on the forehand side, and that's because they're pushing off with that back leg and push, and they're getting that right hip flying forward. And since the leg is connected to the right hip, the back leg comes forward in the follow through, and they're off the ground, especially when they're on the run.
What about mentally? We talked a lot about the technique. What are the similarities? You know, obviously, if you're a champion tennis player, you have the mindset to excel at almost anything, right, mentally. Do you find a lot of similarities with the mental game between tennis and golf or not?
Absolutely. One of the tough things about golf is you got so much time between shots. You got a lot of time to think of all the bad things that can happen, you know, between the drive and your shot to the green, or your shot to the green and then your putt. But in tennis, you know, it seems like you don't have much time, but you do have plenty of time to think of the bad things. You know, even though the ball's coming pretty hard, everything's working very fast in your brain. And you can see, you know, changing your mind. And that's one of the things that players do to make mistakes. They'll change their mind at the last second and hit a bad shot. Players realize that there are critical times when you're playing a match in tennis where you've got plenty of time before you're going to serve to know that this is match point, this is break point, this is a critical point. And you've got to be able to handle that. And there are certain techniques that players use, and breathing and or in preparation before, of keeping focus with, you know, picking on your strings and thinking about what you're going to do before you serve and what you want to do after the serve. And in golf, you've got more than enough time to think about the water that's on the left and then it's out of bounds on the right. And you got to, you know, if you're going to hit it hard, you can try to guide it instead of let your, you know, body move. And I talk about intensity, but not being tense. There's a word tense is in the intensity. So the greatest example I use for intensity is Michael Jordan. You know, you can look at players today like Kobe Bryant or even LeBron James now, being extremely intense, very competitive and focused, but at the same time relaxed. And so that is a key. In tennis, you've got to be relaxed, but you've got to be intense. But you can't be tense. So it relates the same way in tennis and golf. You've got plenty of time in tennis, more time than you'd like to think about the bad things, and then to be able to keep your mind on what you're going to do and then, you know, hit the shot. And generally, it you're thinking about it, but it becomes instinctive of trying the right shots. That's where practice comes into play. As you practice the right shots all the time, then instinctively you're going to hit the right shots, and you're going to be able to do it. But if you practice sloppy tennis and you're not really focused, then all of a sudden It always happens. The worst time in a match, you try a drop shot from behind the baseline, which is such a low percentage situation, or you try to hit it as hard as you can, or you try to, or you push it because you're so tight. And so you gotta. It's great. That's what I love about golf and tennis is you gotta be able to, you know, let your body perform, and at the same time you can't be sloppy about it. You've gotta, you know, really. That's where confidence comes in play. You see a Gary player, whenever you asked him about, I'm sure you did this in some interviews, do you have a chance to win the tournament this week? I guarantee he says, I think I can win this week. Definitely. No matter what age he was, whether he was 20 or 70 or 80, you know, the guy is so confident. And he's confident because he's succeeded and performed well under pressure many times, won some majors. And so he knows that if he plays well, he can beat anybody, and that's what Tiger was. And that, you know, you look at all the great players, Jack, and you just go down the line. They exude this confidence, and you see that with Djokovic, you see that with Fed, you see it with Rafa. These guys exude confidence, and so they only have to worry about a handful of players that think that they can win. Going into the match, they say they can win, but they don't really believe it. And so, you know, the great outcome is Federer wins. He wins. He's happy about that. The guy he beats didn't think he was going to beat him, but may have had a close match, and so he feels good about it. So it's a win-win situation. You know, Fed wins as usual, and the guy he beats, you know, played a close match that match, and he feels good about his game. And so that's where you want to get to the point where you're number one, you're the best player, and the other players are just hoping to do well against you, and that's in tennis. And it even relates to golf. You see, you know, Tiger winning so many matches and Jack winning so many tournaments, or Tiger winning tournaments and Jack winning tournaments, and then Jack coming in second so many times as well in these majors because he was always in the running at the very end. And the great players – also, the great players compete until the end. You know, they give it 100%, and they come back when you never, and you think they're dead. And these guys, these three guys that have won 20 tournaments, you know, haven't done it because they've just had a couple good weeks. They're always competing until the end, and they've lost. I've seen all these guys lose heartbreakers to each other mainly, but heartbreaking matches when they could have, you know, gotten one more major, and the other guy just, you know, competed a little bit better. And that's what it takes in every sport. You got to compete until the end, and that's the thing I respect the most about a guy like Tiger, or Jack was the same way, or all these top golfers. They compete so well, they don't give up, you know, and even if they're out of the running, mm-hmm. they're giving it 100% because it just becomes a habit for them.
And they believe, as you say, that they can win. And it's a fine line. You know, Gary Player and I were talking about this. It's a fine line between sounding cocky and just sounding assured. But if you don't believe that, you have no chance of winning. So you really have to believe you're going to win. I wanted to ask you, when you tee it up at Pro-Am, say, here at the Heritage, you know, the PGA Tour event, or do you get nervous?
Yeah, I'm scared to death on the first tee. I'm going to miss the ball. You know, the ball's not moving, but it's sitting there, and it's trying to laugh at me. And so, you know, I just try to focus and hopefully make contact. But it is fun to be under pressure like that in something you're not familiar with or not as confident about, and to try to perform, you know, and everybody's played some good rounds here and there. So they said, well, maybe I can play that good round today in the heat of battle. And that's what's challenging for, I'm sure it is for the golf, the pros, but even the amateurs, when they play, they'd love to, you know, to play at least close to their top level. And my favorite, there's so many great sayings in golf, but my favorite saying is, a guy misses his shot on the 17th hole, and he's been playing like a dog all day. And he says, I wish I could hit my normal shot at least once. They said I'm all bad the whole day. So, it, you know, it's it, it is it's funny to see the expectations of somebody. If you're a five handicapper, you expect to, par most of the holes and get a few birdies along the way. But when you play in tough competitions where the pins are tucked away and you're trying to, hit great shots, it's not so easy.
Who are some of the professionals you've enjoyed playing with through the years?
Well, I played with Davis Love the day after his 40th birthday, and he said, "I'm not feeling too well, guys." He just done a thing with his motorcycle company, and I probably had a couple too many, but in the first hole he pulled it, and then he had to hook it back to the first green, and he made a 30-footer. Then the next hole he hit a 320-yard drive, hit a 6-iron to about 2 feet on the par five, and made the putt for an eagle. And he said, "Okay, the rest of the day is up to you guys." But Darren Clark was fun. I played when I played with him, I played the back nine first and was playing as well as I could play. I mean, really playing well. And he came up to me, and he's a fun guy. He says, "Well, hitting the ball well, would you like to hit the ball further?" Of course, what are you going to say to that? Of course. And so he gave me a couple tips, and I couldn't play at all after that.
Thanks, Darren Clark.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. I appreciate it. Hubert Green, who was actually my age, I played with him one of the first pro-ams I ever played when I was actually had started playing decently, and I was playing unbelievable. One of my friends, came up and said, "Who's the pro in this group?" And he got a little upset about that. But, it's been fun to play some of these pro-ams here at Harbortown. Then I've gotten to play at the AT&T a few times and at Pebble Beach, and actually shot a 72 there one time. And that we play way up in those white tees, and I hit the ball well. But it's fun to play with the pros and to see them hit the ball and hear the sound. I love to hear the sound because it sounds so much different, when they're hitting it consistently in the center of the club and we're trying to find the club.
Any most memorable moment as far as watching this tournament? I know Stuart Sink has won it 3 times. Davis Love has won it 5 times. There's been some pretty memorable moments here.
There's some great moments. I mean, the one that Davis, told his brother who was on the bag, he was going to chip it in to get into a playoff, and he did. And just in the last couple of years, you got Cooch. It knocked one in from the 18th bunker to win the tournament. One of my favorite memories goes way back, and that was when the tournament was actually played in November early on, and a guy named Frankie Connor was playing here, and Frankie was one of the top junior tennis players in the country, and was a friend of mine, same age, and he went on to play in the pro tour. He played golf in college, and then he was in the third round playing great, and I followed him the third round, and he actually wrote a book on tennis and golf because he did both of them so well. Anyway, he played so well that he was near the top after the third round, and so I was actually really sick, but I put my leather jacket on. It was really cold this day. In fact, Tom Watson was wearing a ski cap, and Charles Fraser went over and tried to grab off his head because it was terrible promotion for Sea Pines Resort. Anyway, to make a long story short, Frankie got into a playoff with Tom Watson.
Wow.
And they played the number 16, and Frankie missed the green, got up and down, tied Tom. And they both hit on the green on 17, that par 3. And Tom had about a 22-footer and just missed the putt. And then Frankie had about a 20-footer to win the tournament. And he grazed the cup, lipped out. And I was down at the below on the 17th. I was actually down at a level, so it was eye level of the ball, and I could see it go to the cup. It just missed. And then Frankie hit it in the marsh on 18, and Tom won the tournament. So that was a unique time because Frankie really was probably the best. Well, he didn't play too much tennis after the juniors. He played golf in college, but he played well, and he won a few senior events. He might have won a regular tour event as well, but he was a good player, and he was got great hands, didn't move too well. That's why he took up golf instead of tennis, because he moved like this table here not too quick.
I have to ask you about the Stan Smith Adidas shoe, because it was so popular back in the 70s, and then suddenly it was resurrected. How did that all come about, Stan? And bring us up to date, because now people who don't play tennis wear the shoe because it's a fashion statement.
Well, there's a lot of stories, but, you know, the shoe was doing pretty well. Then it kind of went through a bad patch, and we had a meeting at Wimbledon. They said, well, we're going to take the shoe off the market in 2012 and 13. And I wasn't too happy to hear that, but they said they were going to bring it back, you know, but they didn't really have a great business plan. And so I really thought that that was it. That was, it had been a good run, but that was it. But in January 15th of 2014, they came out around the world with a whole new strategy, collaboration with several well-known people, including Pharrell Williams and others. The thing took off around the world, and it's been going, you know, it's been going well ever since. And so I went to Adidas around that time and said, we should, I guess after that time, I said, we should do a book to kind of document, you know, how well the shoe has done, and is one of the best-selling shoes. And so they finally, you know, we did it in the book. We finally got a name, and they had a bunch of different names. I said, what about the name I've been thinking about? And it's Stan Smith, Some People Think I'm a Shoe. And so we did that, and the book was done by Rizzoli, and it was a great coffee table book. If you haven't seen it, it's got a lot of great photographs of the shoes, and then just short stories about my career and about the shoe. And it's about 5 pounds, and so it's a good, you know, book to work out with if you don't want to read it. And then just LeBron James's company, a production company, wanted to do, they read the book, actually, and they wanted to do a documentary. And so we just finished a documentary on my life and the shoe, and it's going to come out in February or March, I think. The Sundance, you know, they're hoping to get it there, but the film festival had a few documentaries, and they couldn't quite fit it in, but they're hoping to get the Tribeca Film Festival and get it in there and go from there. But maybe, yeah, maybe so. So anyway, that's been a story about the shoe and about my career. And the shoe is the thing I'm really excited about now is that this year they come out with my shoe in recycled materials. And so the idea is, it's called Prime Green, and the idea is to help save, you know, plastic waste around the world. And so they've made some of my shoes in this at least 50% recycled materials. And the shoe I'm wearing right now actually is a shoe called the line is, it's made to be remade. And the idea behind it is that this shoe is totally made from recycled materials and plastics, and even there's no glue, and there's even it just bound the sole with the upper with thread, and when there's a code on it that you can take the code and then send it in, and they'll throw the whole shoe, including the shoelaces, and chop it up and then make a new pair of shoes out of it. So it's very exciting, and the whole concept, they're using my shoe as sort of the point shoe for this initiative, and they want to have by 2025 all their products made from at least 50% recycled materials. And so Adidas is really putting their money and their products where their mouth is as far as trying to help sustainability. And in fact, just last week I was in New York and was at the Footwear News Achievement Awards, and it's like the Academy of Awards for footwear, and it's the 35th anniversary, and they actually honored me about 5 years ago with the Shoe of the Year, but this time they asked me to introduce this shoe, the Sustainability Leadership Award for Adidas this last week, because of all the things they're doing. In fact, next next year they're going to come out with a shoe that's made of mushrooms. It's called Mycelina. And it's really you look at a mushroom, the bottom part of it is kind of sinewy, and they can put it in a pot and then boil it, and then it'll put it in sheets, and then cut the sheets and use the sheets like they're pieces of leather to make shoes.
Oh my gosh, so innovative.
We're going to have a mushroom shoe coming out next year.
Will your name be attached to that one as well?
Yeah, it's going to be a Stan Smith Mycelina shoe.
Oh my gosh, Stan, are you ever shocked with, when you look back at the shoe and the evolution of your shoe and how it's come back tenfold, does that ever just shock you?
Yeah, it's totally shocking. That's why we had the name on the book, because I did an interview with, I think it was Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago, and they said, well, probably 95% of the people in the world have no idea who I am. They know the name, and they know the shoe, but they have no idea who I am. And my wife piped up, she said, 99% of the people in the world have no idea who you are. So it is funny, and it's fun to walk behind somebody wearing the shoe, and sometimes I'll say to them, how do you keep those things clean, or do you like those shoes, or what do you like about them? And they have no idea, you know, who I am.
I think it's just amazing, and I'm glad that I have I had a pair years ago when they first came out, and a couple years ago I got a new pair for Christmas. So it's see how connected we are all these years. Last question, Stan. You've done so much in your career, on and off the court, on and off the course as well, and in a business standpoint as well. What is yet out there for you that you haven't done yet that you have your eye on? Anything?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I've really enjoyed, we have this academy we started 20 years ago at Sea Pines, the Smith Stearns Tennis Academy, and I'm out there every afternoon when I'm in town, and it's really fun to see these young players, you know, compete and improve. And I think working with young people is really exciting, and to get them, my role really is to encourage them, because so many kids are fighting so many things that they have to, they get discouraged about, and we're not necessarily building world champions, but we're helping them improve in their tennis and hopefully in their confidence, and they're realizing that there's more to life than just you know, going to school and playing tennis, but you know, hopefully there'd be more positive people. And we're kind of very involved with the Boys and Girls Club here, my wife and I, and so we have a big dinner here next year. It's they're honoring an icon is what they're calling it, so we're going to raise some money for the Boys and Girls Club, kind of going through some of my past exploits. But I'm looking forward to the future of what, you know, might be able to do something that can really help young people. I think that's the, you know, that's obviously the future for all of us, and so to give them hope into what they're doing, that's I think the thing that I'd like to do the most.
And you've been doing that for a very long time. What an inspiration. It's been so great to reconnect with the great Stan Smith, and fun to talk golf with you as well. Just I can hear your passion about golf as much as tennis.
The tournament has been great. 52 years here at Harbortown. It's one of the longest, you know, lasting tournaments in one venue, and we have a great group of people that are involved with the staff and with the volunteers, our trustees of the foundation. And back in 96, actually, or 86, the trustees then, I wasn't a trustee then, but about 8 or 9 people stepped forward and guaranteed $100,000 each to cover the purse. Otherwise, the tournament was going to go away. And fortunately, didn't have to use that. We got a sponsor, and it continued onwards. But we've raised about $45 million now for local charities. And I've been the chairman of the charities committee of our foundation the last 10 or 12 years. And so it's been fun to see the tournament and the proceeds from the tournament and all the effort that's being put into it, you know, go to some of these charities in the low country. And we have a lot of kids, a lot of them are children's things, not just that, but that are being helped by the tournament itself.
Well, thanks so much, Stan Smith. I could go on and on and continue talking with you. Thanks for being on Sports Interview.
My pleasure. Hope to see you in New York.
The Sports Interview with Ann Liguori podcast was brought to you by Ivy Cole Luxury Athleisure Wear for Men and Women, featuring the exclusive IceFill cooling technology along with SPF 50 plus sun protection. Look your best. Protect your skin. Visit IBKOL.com to learn more.